You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or subscribe to Brookings Podcasts through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also follow us on Twitter at @policypodcasts.
Welcome. We're really happy to have a wonderful panelist. Wonderful panel full of panelists today. It is September. People are back to school. Congress is in session. Summer is over. International Literacy Day was last Friday. And I couldn't think of a better topic than to spend the afternoon talking about inclusive school environments, improving outcomes for students with and without disabilities. So many thanks to the folks at the Special Olympics, because we're partnering with them, obviously, on this event. And let me do a quick intro of the panelists. You have fulsome bios, so I'm not going to read them all, but just very, very brief introduction. Directly to my left, Tim Shriver, who is chairman of Special Olympics, has many other hats, including founding the CASEL, the Collaborative for Academic Social Emotional Learning, has a wonderful wife, Linda Potter, five kids, so great on parenting advice. if you run out of topics of conversation, yeah. you can move there. Next, we have Cassie Jones. We're very happy to have Cassie. She is a freshman, three weeks into her college experience at the University of Albany. Got special permission from her professors to skip a day of class and be with us. Right after Cassie, we're really happy to welcome Joe Pignatelli, who is a sophomore at Hudson Valley Community College. Both of them, both Cassie and Joe, are youth leaders in the Special Olympics program, which we're going to hear a lot more about momentarily. And certainly last but not least, Professor Haynes, Norris Haynes, is a psychologist. Has, if you look at his bio, he has many, many letters after his name. He also happens to have an MBA, various other things, but has been working in this sector, in this field for a long time, in schools, with kids, one of the leading academics on the topic. And we're really happy to welcome you.
Thank you.
So let me kick it off by first posing a question to you, Tim, and Norris. Because I had some folks asking me definitions. What does special education mean versus inclusive schools? What does what's the difference between, is it intellectual disabilities versus physical disabilities? In Special Olympics world, you talk about unified schools. What can you just tell us a little bit, orient us to the conversation we're going to have, and definitions.
Okay, well, thank you, and thanks to Rebecca for inviting us and to the Brookings team. This is an extraordinary moment. I don't think the Special Olympics movement in our almost 50 years has ever been invited into a scholarly, policy-oriented institution, ever.
Well, welcome.
Yeah, but it's a big landmark for us, so there's a lot of Special Olympics people here, there's a lot of scholars, a lot of policy leaders here. It's an enormous honor for us. Or at least for me, won't speak for everyone, and for my colleagues to be welcome to this setting. And I think it marks a shift, really, in the urgency and importance of the work we're trying to do and the importance of it not just for our organization and movement, but for the country. And I think maybe in some ways Rebecca's wisdom is to see this moment and to see it as an opportunity to think more broadly and with a larger audience about the future of the country, I would venture to say. But let me try to now answer your question. Yoshi's looking at me. Answer the question. Right? So the Special Olympics organization was founded to advocate on behalf of people with intellectual disabilities. Intellectual disability is the new language. It has morphed over the 100 or so years in which the idea has existed. The idea, the concept of intellectual disability really emerges in the late 19th and early 20th century, really with the advent of normative IQ testing. And all of a sudden, people began to be classified by a certain score, and those scores began to dictate terms and expectations. And on one end of the normal curve, you'd find people who would be considered geniuses or extremely intelligent. And on the other end, you'd find people who would be, who would carry other labels. The labels originally allotted to this population were quite horrific. Idiot, imbecile, moron. These were medical terms created to classify people according to IQ scores. And together with that terminology came a whole host of public policy interventions. We were started, which were horrible also, by the way. I won't go into all the details. So our field centers on people who have an intellectual challenge, meaning that on a the definitions have evolved to more functional definitions over time, but basically it is still people who learn at significantly differently from their non-disabled peers. Now, the disability category, of course, includes many people other than people with intellectual disabilities, people with sensory disabilities, hearing, sight, ambulatory disabilities. Most disability policy, I think I can say this, tends to focus on people with physical disabilities, and most of that subset tends to focus on people with mobility challenges. And so the common expression of a, you know, the common symbol for disability is the icon we see all over the place, which is a wheelchair. Whether or not that will be the common symbol 100 years from now, who knows, where we'll shift in terms of our thinking. So intellectual disability is a subset of disability. And intellectual disability, while it is the largest group, single group, is often the most forgotten in the disability conversation. And this includes public policy in the United States and around the world. It includes transportation, housing, healthcare, you name it. Most disability-related policy work doesn't include intellectual disability. I'm going to quickly go to the next two terms. Inclusion. In this country, in the mid-70s, we passed laws that required access to a free education for people with disabilities, including intellectual disabilities. We began the whole edifice that we now call special education to try to close down institutions and move children with disabilities into mainstream schools. So mainstreaming and normalization and inclusion, all these are different words to suggest gradients in the extent to which people, children largely with disabilities, including would be included in normalized settings. We are most interested in the social dimensions of inclusion. The law has been more interested historically in the physical dimensions. Mm-hmm. Did you close the special school and let the people with disabilities move physically to the new school, to the regular school? Doesn't matter whether they're in the basement or in the special ed wing or, you know, at the special ed table or in the special ed bus. At least they're physically proximate. And the law largely suggested, in my view, that physical proximity would more or less take care of the rest. And while physical proximity is, in my view, good, it is not inclusion. It is not certainly social inclusion. It is not meaning, it's not the transformation of hearts and minds. It's not enough. So we're here today to talk about the hearts and minds piece of the social inclusion agenda in schools for people with intellectual disabilities. Was that?
That was a great answer. answer. And I want to pick up, and I want to go to you, Norris, and I'll come back to you, Tim. You know, you brought up the social piece, social and emotional, hearts and minds, the emotional piece.
Yeah.
And part of what I know, because we talk about it a lot, you and I, is the importance of social-emotional learning, not only to inclusive schools movement, but actually every parent should care about social-emotional learning because it helps kids grow, develop, and they do better academically. Norris, this has been your area of work. I mean, a lot of parents around the world are paying lots of extra money for math tutors, literacy tutors, physics tutors, science tutors, and really focused on kids' grades and homework and all that, which is really good. But why should they care about social-emotional learning, and why should they care if their kid does not have an intellectual disability, that they go to an inclusive school?
Right. Well, I think the research is compelling that social and emotional learning does have very positive impacts on children generally and adults. As we look at, for example, some of the specific interventions that embrace inclusive schools, that address culture and climate of schools, we find that children who attend those schools tend to have better experiences, by and large, that they have better outcomes in terms of their behavior, in terms of their achievement, and in terms of, and when they are followed. There are some longitudinal studies that have followed young people who have been in inclusive environments as far as the elements of social and emotional learning are concerned, that they tend also to have better lifetime outcomes over the long term. So I think the evidence does suggest that if we are able to create school cultures and school environments that have both intentional efforts to include social and emotional elements, and that also encourage informal interactions among students, among themselves, that we do get better outcomes. Now, the research is also developing in terms of the impact on students with disabilities. There are about 6.6 million students with disabilities in public schools, right? About 5 to 9% of those children are children who have intellectual disabilities. And that's a substantial number. The research does suggest that when the elements of social and emotional learning, and by that I mean there are five core competencies or elements of social and emotional learning. There's social awareness. There's self-awareness, first of all. There's self-management. There's social awareness. There's relationship skills. And then there is responsible decision-making, right? So there are these five core competencies. And social and emotional learning does attempt to help instill and encourage and develop these competencies among kids in schools. We have found that when some of them, all of them, or some of them in combination are implemented, because different programs emphasize different aspects of social and emotional learning, that we find that the outcomes tend to be very positive. Schools that include and embrace all of those elements together, synergistically, tend to have even better outcomes. So it's clear that as we attempt to create environments and cultures that support kids with disabilities, particularly kids with intellectual disabilities, that social and emotional learning does make a significant difference. And the research is very, very compelling about that.
And I think for me, one of the things that is most striking that I don't think the average parent realizes, and I'm curious, Tim, I'd be curious to hear from you. You know, do you think average school principal or average teacher understands basically Norris's quick recap of the literature that outcomes for both kids with and without disabilities go up?
No, I don't think most people understand. I think most people look at someone who has a special need and says, well, the school has to provide services for them. Many Americans think that's a net loss for their kid if their kid doesn't have special needs. In fact, the polling on this has gotten better over time, but most Americans still don't want a child with special needs in their child's school or classroom today. It's a smaller majority, but it's still a majority who do not believe that their child will benefit. In fact, they think there may be a risk to their child's safety or a risk to their child's learning. So the perception is that a service given to a special needs student is a net loss because it's a finite pie. What they don't see is the interaction, the relationship power, the inspiration, the grit, the resilience, the perseverance, the empathy, the compassion that animates the entire school, right? And all of a sudden, enlivens children who don't have disabilities just as much as that interaction enlivens those who do. We're getting better at studying that. Norris is helping on this, and we need more scholarship on this issue, because as long as we see any, frankly, any minority group, if we can even use that language, as basically a subtraction agenda from the whole rather than additive to the whole, I think we'll always be in a kind of an identity battle. Like if we're going to adapt to issues around race and equity, or if we're going to adapt to issues around disability, that's going to take away from normative learning. It's actually the opposite. It enhances normative learning. But we have to start talking that way. The interactions in learning, the relationships in learning are actually additive for all kids. Mm. K kids without disabilities, in our experience, I would almost say benefit more from unified sports and inclusive programs than kids with disabilities. And this is the big discovery of the last 5 or so years. If you went around this room, I'm guessing maybe a handful of people who have been involved in Special Olympics. I would bet that if we did a survey, those who do not have an intellectual challenge would probably rank higher in terms of the effect it had on their lives than even those for whom the kind of experience was designed.
I never asked you this, but when you founded Special Olympics, was social-emotional learning at the center always, or did it
slowly? Social-emotional learning is only a 20-year-old term, even. I mean, the term we created in the early 90s. Social development, emotional development, obviously those are not new terms, but the idea that learning, that those skills were malleable, that you could actually improve your problem solving, your coping strategies, your stress management strategies, your relationship strategies, that if you improved them, you would have better health outcomes, better learning outcomes, that's relatively new. What was always the case, I believe, in the Special Olympics movement, and it's funny because if you ask people what Special Olympics is, they say it's sports. And it is. But the primary vector of change is heart and is emotional and relational. So while we're playing basketball or bocce, the real transformation isn't just in your three-point shot or your capacity to hit the ball. Your real transformation is in your attitude and your mindset, if you will, in your worldview, in your capacity to see difference and see yourself. Those are the ways in which our movement from 1968 till today has shaped and changed lives.
And do you see, I know we've talked about this some in the past, do you think that trajectory of Special Olympics, having that as a kernel, but becoming, it sounds to me, what you just said, coming much more focused on that as sort of the core and being able to articulate it better, right? Having a lexicon, having, you know, Norris and his peers really kind of honing in and defining it. Have other, you know, are you a lone organization out there talking about this? Or is there a rising tide of awareness around social emotional learning? Where are we at in the field?
So social emotional learning is booming today. State legislatures, superintendents, teachers' organizations. We've completed in the last few years polls of teachers. Over 90% want more. Soon to be released poll of principals and supervisors. Over 90% want better implementation strategies around social and emotional learning. So I believe that concept its time has come. It should never have not been the case, but now its time has come. The idea that young people with disabilities are powerful teachers of these qualities, powerful influencers to make a culture more compassionate, more gritty.
I know what you mean when we say gritty, but you're not talking about sand. So in case anybody who doesn't follow
more perseverance,
Angela Duckworth's work.
So grit is the quality of being able to focus on a goal and not be deterred by failure. So it's not just focus, it's also not be deterred by failure. There are no subset population in the world with more grit than people with intellectual disabilities. There's just, you just can't find it. I don't care. Go to all the Nobel Prize winners, find, you know, Elon Musk sending rockets into space. You can knock them all out. You're going to hear from Joe in a minute. You'll see what I mean. But kids can see this. Kids can watch it in third grade when they see their peer who maybe has, let's say, Downs or autism or Williams, and they see them pushing themselves, and they hear the mocking on the school bus, and they see the ridicule in others, and they see that peer who's still going after it, who's still trying, who's riding right through that, who's undeterred by it, who's taking a shot, missing, shot, miss, shot, and over again, and they can intuit right away that child has something I actually want, not something I pity. And for too long, we've framed all these qualities in terms of the dis side of the ability. I think we're getting to the point where we're seeing that sort of a field of neurodiversity, which is a new term, that begins to appreciate the neurodiversity in this room, and that there's not just a normal curve. If we started with the normal curve, where we all would find our little ranking in a with a line on an IQ test, that that's really a very bad distortion of human experience. It's one measure of it, but there are thousands and thousands of measures that we could embrace if we saw ourselves with the, in the diversity that we all are. So I think someday we'll get, I've told Rebecca this, I think, you know, Title IX shifted the landscape. How many people are old enough to have gone to a school before there was a women's or a girls' sports team in it, right? Some of you. And the rest of you probably are still somewhat shocked that there could have been a time when the average American school had a boys' basketball team and a football team and a baseball team and no girls' teams. But Title IX changed that, made it illegal. Lose your funding if you do not provide equal opportunity for women and girls. Bravo. 40 years old now, plus. Someday we'll have the same law that says if you don't provide a unified sports team where children with and without disabilities play on the team together at the varsity level with the same field and the same coach and the same bus, the same uniforms, the same pep rallies and the same coverage in the school newspaper, the same assemblies, the same announcements, that someday our grandchildren will look back and say, Mom, Dad, did you go to a school when they didn't have a unified sports, really, what was it like? What was it like? And we'll have to answer. But hopefully we'll be able to answer, this group helped change that.
I think that's the perfect segue to go to you, Joe. Because you have played lots of sports, of course, being a youth advocate for Special Olympics, basketball, bowling, what else? Swimming. But tell us a little bit. First of all, tell us where you grew up and what high school you went to.
So I grew up in Mechanicville, New York, and I went to Mechanicville High School. And I am a sophomore at Hudson Valley Community College now, and I'm going into the field of human services and chemical dependency. Now we need to get back to why we're here today, because that's to talk about the unified. So I was going through a really tough time back in high school, you know, being outcasted, secluded, just felt like nothing, you know, nobody would talk to me, you know. But so then I made some decisions, but the decisions got me kicked out of my high school. So, well, I had to go to an alternative school. So then when I came back from the alternative school, I got into the unified program. And, it was just starting up. But I noticed a drastic change in my life. And so the unified program, it helped me create more friends. It helped me to learn who I was, learn about everybody else, you know, just because we have a disability doesn't make us any different. We're still like a regular person, you know, and we can still do the same things as anybody else can do. And so by playing basketball, you know, you build the friendships and, you know, you could high-five each other in the hallways, and it's a wonderful program as to, it promotes acceptance, leadership, friendship, stuff like that. And it just made me feel better, and I just learned who I was and how I overcame my challenges. So it helped me and helped change who I am and why I want to go into the human services field and help others.
I didn't even have any tee-up questions. That was fabulous. Thank you so much.
Answered them all.
I know. Applause. Absolutely. The thing I was curious to ask you, Joe, but could you tell us a little bit more about it? You know, one of the things, because we were talking right before the event, and you said you really weren't that interested in school before you left, before you were taking part in the unified program. So, you know, clearly it was a very difficult social environment and very demoralizing and unjust, I would say. But academically, what impact did that have on you? And then how did it change, how did you think about your classes differently when you came back in the unified program?
Academically, I wasn't doing so well, and, you know, classes were, like, boring, and you know, they weren't really used to me, as I felt anyways. But then when I came back to my home school and I went through the Unified program, it seemed to me like school was very important, that you need school to succeed in life. And, you know, school is very important. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it doesn't make a difference if you're in the special ed department or you're in a regular ed department, because there shouldn't be no boundary between the two, you know, because that's how I feel. You know, there it needs to be more open, you know, everybody, there shouldn't be no barriers in high school today. But.
And you were actively participating in the sports program, because I know Special Olympics has a couple of elements. One is basically developing social-emotional learning competencies and improving school climate through sports, unified sports. Yes. And then there's another component, Cassie, which is what you were involved in, which is around youth leadership. So can you tell us where you went to high school and what your experience was with Special Olympics?
I went to Gates Chalet High School, which is in Rochester, and as much as I wanted to be on the unified basketball team, because it is a varsity sport and I played varsity softball in the same season, I couldn't play on that team, which really kind of sucked because it was going to be a really good time. So they gave me another opportunity to get involved with Unified Champion Schools, Unified Sports, by being on the YAC, or the Youth Activation Committee, which is kind of funny because everyone's like, the YAC, and I'm like, yeah, the YAC. And what the Youth Activation Committee does is basically kind of spreads the word about this really new program, Unified Sports, within their schools. So I would be in charge of putting posters up to tell people when the games were, or we'd have fundraisers in the lunchroom to just kind of start the conversation about what's really going on in our school as far as the seclusion of people who have intellectual disabilities, and why it's a problem and why we should be talking about it. And I would just kind of be that person to branch the problem and the solution, and to speak with the.
What was it like? So before, because you, when did the program start at your school? Mid your high school.
I was a sophomore.
Yeah, sophomore.
Yes,
okay.
I was a sophomore.
So, just as an example, in the cafeteria.
Yes.
Your freshman year, what was it like? And then in the cafeteria, your junior year or senior
sure.
year, what was it like?
Freshman year, I could not tell you that I saw anyone who had an intellectual disability eating in the cafeteria. Quite frankly, freshman year, I didn't see anyone with an intellectual disability in the hallways at all. I mean,
Did you know there were kids at the school?
I knew they were there, but I'm sure a lot of people didn't, because everything was centered in a way where they were going through the hallway when we weren't. They were eating when we weren't. And when Unified Champion Schools and Unified Sports kind of started up and the YAC started to become a voice within the school, my junior and senior year, I started to see kids who had intellectual disabilities eating lunch with us. And there was a guy that I knew so close to my heart who would eat lunch with us and ask us for help with his homework and talk our ear off. And he no longer sat in his homeroom and ate his lunch, and he would say hi to us in the hallway and high-five us and everything. So it was this huge drastic difference, because we could feel their presence there instead of just, you know, kind of knowing they were there somewhere in the back.
And clearly you were very motivated and very passionate, but what would you say an average kid at your school thought about the Unified program?
Well, first they'd say, Unified? I'd say, yeah, Unified Sports. What's that? It's when you have kids with an intellectual disability and without playing on a basketball team together. And they'd say, well, that seems pretty cool.
Right.
Yeah, it is really cool. And so there wasn't any, like, distaste for it. It was just like, wow, I've never thought about that. I think that would be a really good idea. I agree. and then they would be really interested in going to the games and learning more about it. And even joining the teams, especially people, you know, who aren't on, like, varsity basketball, since basketball is, like, the starting point for Unified Sports. They'd be like, yeah, I'd love to play basketball and make some new friends and do that sort of thing. So they were very open and perceptive to it and wanted to learn the message that we were trying to send. So.
And what did you feel you got out of it, personally?
I learned how to be a better leader. I learned how to be to have a louder voice than I already do, and to really just kind of advocate for other people and for myself. And it kind of directed me where I want to go in the future. Like, I would like to run for an elected office someday. And
which we've encouraged her to
yeah.
do.
And this is the start of my campaign.
You heard it here. 10 years hence.
Yeah.
Senator.
I know.
Jones.
Come back.
No, but it really directed me towards wanting to major in political science and wanting to stand up for people and kind of do what's right. And that's where I'm going to go with it. And I think working with Special Olympics has made me realize that dream.
I'm really so pleased that you guys took time out from your classes to come be with us.
Yeah.
I mean, it adds so much to you know, just hear from people who are going through the program. So thank you. Thank you both for doing that and for your involvement in this great initiative. Norris, I wanna turn to you because Joe and Cassie have given us an example from Special Olympics of an intervention that is exemplifying the types of things we can do to support that type of school climate and school culture that you talked about that's so important for developing SEL competencies and, frankly, academic learning. Can you give us some other examples of other organizations, other interventions, other programs that you, in your many years studying this, have found to be particularly effective or when you were delivering them,
sure.
when you were practicing?
Yeah. Sure. Well, I'd like to say that I think we have cross-validation of the research right here.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's we see live what the research speaks to, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the, before I answer your question directly, I think one of the things that, one of the findings that I think is really very, very compelling about how social and emotional learning impacts the culture and climate mm. of environments is the finding that individuals who associate with, who interact with students with learning disabilities or intellectual disabilities or any kind of disability do experience changes in their attitudes and their perceptions of these individuals. They have completely different perspectives on what it means to be a person living with a disability and how to better interact and respond to them. So for example, and let me just, for example, give you how one of the key components, self-awareness, for example, mm-hmm. Which is one of the core competencies of social and emotional, and how that operates in a school environment, as an example. Individuals who are not aware of the way they perceive and react to others, when they are taught how to become self-aware, and you can actually be taught how to become more self-aware, they really begin to see their attitudes and their behaviors differently. And then we go to the self-management, where they begin to then manage their behaviors that result from those perceptions. This is also true of academics. When people become aware of how they approach their work and their studies, how they feel about a particular subject area, when they become aware of that, then they become better able to manage their response to the academics, and that in turn has significant impact on the outcomes that we see. So and then we can go through the different competencies and talk about how they actually become operational and how they in fact change our behavior and our attitudes. In terms of other programs, there are several. I can talk about, for example, Mark Brackett at Yale University, who has a program called RULER, R-U-L-E-R. And Mark Brackett and his colleagues have been experiencing tremendous success with their programs all over the country, in New York, in Connecticut, in some international countries as well.
What does the RULER program do?
RULER is an acronym for Recognizing, Understanding Your Emotions,
okay.
Labeling Your Emotions, and then responding to what you feel in real time.
Mm-hmm.
And there are curricula that they have developed. There's staff training. Teachers are trained. Mm-hmm. Administrators are trained, which is very important because the administrator helps to create the climate and the culture of the school and the vision for the school. You know, I now teach a doctorate program in leadership. And one of the things that has become very clear is that the vision and the mission of the school is extremely important in terms of how the climate becomes operational. So so the training is a big part of that, and actual in-classroom interactions with staff and with students. So that's a very effective program. Then we have Maurice Elias, for example, at Rutgers University, who also has a very effective program of training and development in social and emotional learning. And there are several other programs around the country that what all of them have in common is the idea that we can teach, you know, the core competencies in different ways, and they use different strategies for doing that. But the bottom line lesson is that we can actually help people to become more social and emotionally aware. As you know, Daniel Goleman in his very early work talked about SEQ, social and emotional quotient, mm-hmm. or social and emotional intelligence. And even in Dan Goldman's work, even in the business arena, he has found that business leaders who are social and emotionally intelligent leaders tend to have much better outcomes in their organizations and more satisfied workers in their organizations. So I think the research across the spectrum in terms of academics and in terms of business, I think the research is very compelling. And there are a number of different programs. A good resource for really learning more about specific programs and how they actually rated in terms of their scientific rigor as far as their research is a document by the Collaborative for Academic, Social, and Emotional Learning. And they have compiled a lot of research on social and emotional learning programs. The document is called Safe and Sound, right? It's something that we developed years ago, and it continues to be a very valuable document for looking at what programs are there out there in social and emotional learning, how rigorous they are in terms of implementation and in terms of their research to validate their findings. And one other thing I should mention is that many states are now adopting social and emotional learning as part of their requirements for teacher training and for student performance. And some members of Congress have actually introduced legislation to actually encourage the use of social and emotional learning strategies in schools across the country.
Thank you. Thank you, Norris. Tim, I wanted to pick up on that for what Norris just said as he introduced Congress and policymakers. Before we go to Congress, let's talk globally, the world. Special Olympics is in 170 countries.
Yeah.
There's not that many more countries left.
There's a few more left, and we'll get there.
I want to ask you a question about this movement globally. Basically, what Norris has just been talking about, what Cassie and Joe explained to us in terms of their experience as a concrete example. Some of the work that we've been doing at the Center for Universal Education, we have an initiative called Skills for a Changing World. And it really is looking at, you know, what are the sets of competency, skills, and abilities young people need to be able to thrive, not just today, but into the future in a very fast-changing world. And we recently, the team did, scholars, Esther Cairn and various others, Helen Kim, did a survey of over 100 countries, and they looked at a whole bunch of things, but they looked at national policy objectives and priorities, they looked at curricular frameworks, etc. And they found that out of the 100 countries, 75% of national Ministry of Education goals, aims, visions, objectives are to ensure that kids have both success in academic competencies and skills, as well as, and they didn't always use the term social emotional learning, but they certainly used other terms like it. And a lot of them linked it back in their rationale and their statements to what Norris just said, that for skills for work, increasingly as things get automated or the world gets more complex, or it's always frankly maybe just been this way and we're recognizing it more, not only do you need good technical skills, but you need good interpersonal skills, collaboration skills, teamwork skills, problem-solving skills, stuff like that. So I guess the question to you is, you know, what does this all add up to in a policy arena? You know, globally, and then we can come back to the U.S. later, but...
Well, I mean, I think there's two things. I think, first of all, the point you're making about the economic value. So there's so many ways in which this stuff operates positively. Like, you have one intervention and, like, 50 good outcomes. And so for a policy person, the question is, which one do we want to emphasize? Which is an okay question, except I hate to narrow too much, mm-hmm. right? So you're mentioning employability skills. The Business Roundtable, the Chamber of Commerce, all major employers, even Google, will tell you that their new screens for hiring have more to do with teamwork, initiative, flexibility, problem solving than it does with coding.
Self-awareness.
Yeah. So the skill set we need for these two people in the center of this will have no problem getting a job. I mean, I don't want to make it too easy for you guys, but they're going to get jobs. You can just tell, right? If any of you were hiring, you'd walk up here afterwards and say, hey, by the way, send me your resume. Because you can see, you can sense this is a self-starter, this is a competent person, this is a person who will get along with others, this is a person who will join a team, this is a person, I mean, you can just tell, right? They've got it, right? You just, in the old-fashioned sense, they've got it. You don't know what their test scores are. I don't. You don't know what their grades were in college or in high school, but you intuitively can see that the competencies are designed for the 21st century. The health outcomes are comparable also. What you have in this little piece of paper here is a study that just came out about 3 weeks ago in child development, this long-term meta-analysis. Look on this page that says monetary benefits too. So if you're a policymaker and you're thinking, we want to reduce conduct disorders in children, that's almost a $4 million question. One conduct disorder prevented. One.
What's a conduct disorder?
A conduct disorder is a grouping of behavioral and emotional problems. It's a fairly significant, it's a person who's developed a fairly significant challenge in adapting to normal living. So the savings, if you can prevent a child from developing a conduct disorder, not to mention a sexually transmitted disease or an arrest, are in the hundreds of thousands to millions of dollars per person. Per person. So the policymaker who's got even close to a financial lens is going to look at this data and go, okay, so we can get this unified sports program going, and we can teach some self-regulation and some grit, and we have a good chance of getting these kinds of returns. I mean, it's almost a no-brainer. But I would add one more level. And maybe this is leaving the research arena and now thinking a little bit more maybe politically in the larger sense. To me, inclusion is the issue of our time. It is the planet's issue, in my view. Yes, we have big environmental challenges. Yes, we have political challenges, transparency, corruption. I mean, there's many big issues. But if from where I sit, the extent to which our younger kids grow up learning how to welcome difference is the extent to which the planet has a chance. I mean, you don't have to look further than this city we're sitting in. So I think policymakers are responding on multiple levels internationally. They don't necessarily know the how. Mm. This is where the problem is. They're putting this into their guidelines. They're reading sustainable development goals. They're saying we want inclusive education. They don't necessarily execute. But I think on many levels, financial, economic, health, social, academic, and then ultimately political, they're saying we've got to get our kids to grow up caring about one another and capable of bridging differences. Otherwise, we don't have a chance.
Actually, you bring up something very interesting. In that survey of that my colleagues did in the Skills for a Changing World initiative, you know, of the plus 100 countries they surveyed, 75% had these goals for these outcomes, right? Kind of a broad breadth of skills, a range of skills, but only less than 15% had a clear active plan to how to get there.
So that's why Soren Palumbo is here at Special Olympics to lead the world in creating an active plan. And, you know,
the plan maker for the world.
Yeah, well, the plan maker for the world. And Nicole Preston, who leads Special Olympics here in Washington, maybe Nicole, wave your hand, who's trying to do this for the city of Washington, D.C. Most of us work or live somewhere either in the city or near it. That's an important place, too. The proof is in the pudding. I mean, one of my favorite stories, I just came back from Cleveland about 2 months ago. We were visiting schools, and I was with a principal at a round table. And the principal said, well, you know, I'm 30 years in school. I said the first 15 or so years was in the Catholic school system. I was totally against social and emotional. This is soft stuff. We got to focus on academics. I said, what changed your mind? She said, well, my child was 8 years old, second grader. And she was going to a school where they'd introduced this. And this mom was telling me she didn't know that these programs had been introduced. So they were driving home one day, and the daughter turns and says, she's in the back seat, in the car seat, let's stop at McDonald's. I want to get French fries. And the mom says, no, we stopped yesterday. I guess they have a rule. They only stop once a week, only French fries once a week in this family. So
good rule.
So yeah. She says, so my daughter starts screaming, no, I want to stop, mommy, please. And she says, no, we're not stopping. And so her daughter starts screaming, I want to stop, has a tantrum, screaming, spitting, you know, loud, crying. And she's like trying to ignore her. And all of a sudden, the back seat is silent. And she pulls up to the red light and she looks around. She thinks maybe her daughter's had a seizure. I mean, she's really worried. And she looks in the back seat and she sees her daughter in her car seat and she's all like this. And she says, what are you doing? And the daughter looks up and says, Mom, I'm doing turtle.
I learned turtle.
You knew, right?
Yeah.
I'm going to teach my kids turtle.
Yeah, okay. So she says, Mom, don't you know what turtle is? Turtle is when we hold our shoulders and we hold our bodies nice and tight and we close our eyes and we take a deep breath and we let go of our stress.
We should all do turtle.
So the mom's like, whatever she's got, I want. You know, it's that scene out of When Harry Met Sally. Whatever she's ordering, whatever she's having, I'm having. Okay. So the proof is, so at one level, the policymaker will go, we want this. At another level, the execution, the building of the unified sports team, the construction of a turtle instructional program, the allowance of new voices and agency in the school, then you start to give the policymakers the tools to not just talk the talk, but actually implement and get this kind of data. And then I think we have not just a new kitschy education movement, but a social change movement, which is where we want to live.
And for one...
That makes sense, Joe? You guys, I finally got a smile out of you.
That makes sense.
Did you know turtle?
No.
I know. I'm just learning about turtle for the first time, but I think it's a brilliant idea. I told you at the beginning, parenting advice, right? But final comment from Cassie and Joe. For the advocates in the audience, or even from you, Norris, from the researchers in the audience, from the journalists, NGO workers, educators, teachers, perhaps, what advice would you give all of us in terms of how we should get involved, what we should do to help this movement? Either of you.
First,
you go first.
I'll go first, yes. What advice would I give you guys? Definitely take it in. Like, really listen to what the facts are. Take in our stories. Take in all the stories that Special Olympics has documented that we just can't have enough time to talk about in front of you guys. And really recognize the progress that's being made already just within the short period of time. I mean, Unified Champion Schools has only been in my region for a couple of years, and it's already made such a huge impact. So there's really not a downside to being involved with this program or to advocate for it or to put money into it or whatever you are thinking about doing. It's a win for everyone.
Great. Thanks, Cassie.
That
Joe?
Answers your question.
I mean, I just think everybody should be involved with the program because, I mean, I forgot to throw out earlier that, you know, this is a real sport and it does promote friendship. And it's not about the uniform or it's about who you are and you guys coming together and working together, and it's about a team. It's about a team effort. You know, it's not just oh, my kid plays basketball, and he's so big he can play basketball. It's about everybody coming together as a team. Like, instead of saying my kid plays basketball, our kids play basketball. Mm. This is our generation. Mm-hmm. We need to have the brighter kids in the world.
And I think you should consider running for office too. Yeah. Joe.
I know, because I've got a lot to say.
Yeah, I know. thank you all. I think we have, what do we have, 30, I need some glasses, 35 minutes left. And why don't we open it up to the audience for questions and comments. We'll take a couple, and then you guys take your notes, and we'll see who responds best. No, I'm joking. One, two, three, right here, right in the front, and then we'll come to this side. And if you could state your name and your organization.
June O'Connell, Cassie and Joe in particular. I'd like you to dial it back for me and explain whether or not you went to high schools that were one high school in a town as opposed to multiple high schools. Because increasingly, in areas like this, you have economic segregation within the high schools. So you don't have inclusiveness because one high school has people who have million-dollar homes, mm-hmm. and another high school yeah. has 70% on school lunch programs.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to understand where what you're talking about plays into school systems that are increasingly becoming economically segregated.
Great, great question. Let's see, wait, yeah, here and then here. Yes, please.
Hi, thank you all. I've learned a lot. I'm Dr. Mindy Reiser. I'm vice president of a non-governmental organization. It's called Global Peace Services USA. We're interested in peace building and conflict resolution. And certainly what you're doing here leads to that, people understanding each other, appreciating each other, valuing each other. My question focuses on the broader global developments, and I wish some of you could talk to what's happening in other parts of the world. We find in Northern Europe sometimes innovative programs. Are they doing interesting things in Asia? What can we learn from them? So I think that would be helpful to us.
Great. Thanks. And right on the end here, please.
Hi, I'm Michael Shea. I also have many hats. I guess for today, I'll say I'm on advisory committees in Arlington County for the schools. One of the things that's changing is what a classroom is, so inclusion changes. In Virginia, we're putting a big push on work-based learning opportunities. Mm-hmm. And for anyone with disabilities, that's its own set of challenges. So I'm curious, in examples with the unified sports teams, if you've seen that help a school system broaden those opportunities for its students. Mm-hmm.
Broaden
work-based opportunities, internships, that sort of thing.
And there was a hand on this side, way at the back. Yeah, go ahead. The young woman way at the back. Yeah. No, yeah, wait for the mic, honey.
Thank you. Honey. Hi, that's a little better. I wanted to follow up on the question about the global state of inclusion. My name is Emily, and I am a master's student in the International Education Program at George Washington University, specializing in pre-primary and primary teacher training in developing countries. So I'm interested in, from your perspective, what the first steps are that need to be taken in countries where there is no perception of intellectual disabilities.
That's a great question. We'll have one final one here, and then this, we're going to be segregated, left side, right side. So this side, not an inclusive Q&A session. This side will come after you guys respond. So last question, and then you guys can respond.
Sure. Good afternoon. My name is Chiom Oru, and my question is around early interventions. We're talking about high schools, right? But we know that inclusion is extremely important at all ages. And so I just also want to plug for our Special Olympics DC here, also really working with the Young Athletes Program to have that be more present in all schools. But I'm wanting to hear you all's thoughts at the early times in life when children are being struggling with inclusion and their disabilities. Thank you.
Yeah. Norris, why don't we start with you and we'll end up with you.
Sure.
Don't answer all of them. Okay. Pick your favorite one.
Well, the United States... I don't want to say that the United States is unique, but the United States perhaps approaches the issue of people with disabilities in some critical ways that are different from other countries. I think, for example, legislatively, I think that there are two drivers, as I see it, in terms of the issue of inclusion, right? One driver is the legislative driver, in which we have laws like IDEA, the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, the American Disabilities Act. We have Title 504 of the Civil Rights Act. And these legislative initiatives, to some extent, drive policy and practice with respect to how people with disabilities are, in fact, treated and included, right? The other driver I see as what I call the more humanistic, you know, approach to working with individuals with disability, which appeals to our sense of humanity, our sense of the dignity and rights of others, right? So which is sort of the social justice driver in the way we approach people with disabilities. So I think these two kind of come together here in the United States in ways that they probably do not in other societies, at least based on my reading of the research and the policies and practices. Now, having said that, you know, I actually was at a UN meeting, a group of folks from the UN several months ago, where we were talking about autism, right? And I know that one of the main thrusts of the United Nations is the addressing of autism in developing countries, places like Africa and in the Caribbean and so on. So I think that and during that meeting, it was clear that in many of these developing countries, individual folks are struggling with how to to make people more aware, right? To make people more aware of the needs of people who have disabilities and to get them to respond differently. And I think that the development of the humanistic and even the legislative agendas in these countries are evolving, right? These are evolving. So I think there are efforts internationally, globally. I think some countries are ahead of others. I think many of these countries still have a way to go before they institute policies and practices that are developing in the United States. However, I would hasten to add that even here in the United States, we still have a way to go. Mm-hmm. And other panelists mentioned, and as Tim so eloquently stated, I think the issue of inclusion for us in the United States, I think that's where we are now in our progression. I think we need to do more in terms of the inclusion of policies and practices that we have. I think other countries are still behind and working together in some cases, but I think they also have a way to go.
Great. Thanks, Norris. Yeah. Joe or Cassie, you want to respond? There was a question I know was directly addressed to you, but perhaps you can respond to others.
Actually, Joe, if you remember, this gentleman over here was asking about jobs and internships. Maybe you want to tell them about your internship at the ARC.
Yeah. So, I'm doing an internship at the ARC, which is an agency that helps out people with developmental disabilities. And so, currently, I do home visits and stuff. So, my internship is going good.
What do you do there?
What do I do?
Yeah.
I help out. I kind of shadow different positions of the agency so I can get a better understanding of what goes on there and what they should work on and how their operation runs. Mm-hmm. So it gives me kind of a basic outline of what the program is and what positions I could possibly look at.
Awesome.
Great. Yeah. Thanks. Cassie, do you want to chime in?
I was Well, I can't speak to that, but I wanted to address the question up here. I come from Rochester, New York, and I don't know if anyone knows a lot about Rochester, but it's a very diverse place. It's a city that's surrounded by suburbia and then another layer of the upper middle class. And so the people that I go to school with personally at my school are of varying ethnicities, social backgrounds, have different varying amounts of medium income. So I would say that unified sports is a great way to bridge all of those differences together, not just between people who have intellectual disabilities and without, but both people who are of different races, have different backgrounds, and it's just a great program to just say that there aren't, that those differences aren't, right. You know what I'm trying to say? Like, yeah. Those differences aren't that big of a deal, that we're all the same, and it really helps to realize that we're not all that different, despite the fact that some of the things that we're going through.
Right. All right, but you know, the what you were talking about like the higher end of the wealth and the poverty, like, I don't think it matters, basically, to me, because if you're talking about unified, it's not going to have that in it. That's not part of it. It's part of who you are, and it's part of supporting one another. But, like, Mechanicville is, like, it's in the middle, because, like, we're not really into poverty, but we're not extremely poor. We're more middle class. But that doesn't make a difference, again, because we're all the same individual.
Tim, do you want to chime in on that,
so,
or a different one?
Yeah. Fascinating. You know, Joe's used this, you've said it's about who you are about four times. I don't know if everybody else heard that as much as I did. But it really moves me when you go back to that issue. It's an what a psychologist might call an identity expression, right? You're not saying it's this skill or this color or this race. It's an identity issue. This is about your identity, right? Which is such an extraordinarily powerful educational question that kids are struggling, especially, I mean, older kids, but all kids, trying to figure out who they are. And you've said, I mean, the rest of us talk about all our theories and everything, but you keep coming back to the core question. So I think that's just beautiful. So thank you for that.
You're welcome.
And for locating identity as transcending income, race, housing patterns, geography, all these other issues, which is, of course, the whole point, right? This is what people do learn when they get into these encounters. They learn that identity can transcend difference, as they've so beautifully put. So just very quick answers to the other issues. A couple of people mentioned early childhood. In some ways, early childhood, pre-K, early childhood, the field has led all educators, the whole culture on this issue. If you can go back 50 and 60 years and find kindergarten report cards that will have social development on the report card. Behavior. But behavior often framed as, you know, manners, takes turns, is kind to others. Now, of course, that disappears from the report card progressively as you get older, as though taking turns and having manners and being kind to others no longer matters. If you're going to get a job at Brookings, you don't need to take turns or be kind. Just kidding.
We do have to do the turtle, though.
There's a differentiation. It's important. So in some ways, the early childhood stuff is kind of getting pushed up into the larger context of what people ought to learn. So in that way, the rest of educators, I think, are starting to learn from early childhood educators. But the truth is, when you think internationally, I'll just take the international question, obviously, very briefly, there's an enormous diversity. The best we can tell is about 90% of kids with intellectual disability never go to school at all.
Globally.
Never go to a school of any kind, any type, at any age. 90%. The lowest estimate would be 70%. The more normative estimates would be 90. So in most places, having Down syndrome means you never go to school. Means your family is permanently stigmatized. Means you are 2 and 3 times more likely to become poor if you are not already poor, or to become poorer if you are poor. Means you're more likely to have the father leave the house and therefore leave a mother to care for the child alone. So it is still quite a severe challenge. And this is one of the reasons why, again, I'm so happy we're here, because the international education community has largely not yet, although beginning now, has largely not yet focused on what equity or inclusion means for this population. Women and girls, obviously the last 10 years, good progress, not enough, but progress. But when it comes to disability, almost, it's just beginning to hit the radar. So we have a long way to go.
And Tim, not to answer for you, but I think one important thing to add, or it's a question really to you in your response to this question, you know, my limited understanding of this topic is that the data is really patchy.
The data
is that because we don't even actually have an idea of the total population of kids with.
I can say on the bright side, in the last 2-3 weeks from now, I'll be in Italy meeting with educators there who are trying to expand unified sports in schools. Russia has a goal of expanding into thousands of schools with unified sports in the next 5 years. China has been on the front end working with us around including sports and inclusion from a very segregated system or a segregated base. In the United Arab Emirates, they not only are working on the unified schools, but they also have now a new moral education program. You mentioned different language. The language they use around social and emotional development tends to focus on moral development. But the underlying skill structure is very similar to what Nora's described earlier. So we're seeing countries around the world, Panama, very interested in having an aggressive nationwide inclusion strategy, and other countries as well. But if you're interested from a policy or a research or a future employment point of view, this is a field that's just beginning, honestly speaking. We have a long way to go everywhere. But we have, you know, my bright spot is this generation. I think this generation, not just the two we've got here, who are extraordinary, but I think this is the inclusive generation. This is a generation that all over the world has grown up with a more open-minded attitude than any generation, I believe, in history. I don't have the data for it, but I think it's there. And I think they will demand all over the world that these issues, these old stigmas, of which disability is one, but that these old stigmas yield. Now, you could say politically you don't see it today, but I've been to very red states. I mean, people say this is a red-blue issue. It's not. Kids in very red environments. I'll tell one last very quick story. I was in a school, Papillion, La Vista South, Omaha, Nebraska, outside of Omaha, big 2,500-student school. Andrea Kahn from our team has been working with them in Nebraska and other states. They have an assembly, 2,500 kids, 100-piece brass band, all the kids assembled there. And in down the middle for this ceremony comes the kids with special needs and their non-disabled partners. And the place is cheering like it was the finals of the Final Four. And one young woman, 17 years old, I don't have her name, gets up in front of all her peers at that age and says, you know, up until recently, I didn't want to get out of bed in the morning. And I didn't want to come to school. And this is with superintendents there. I mean, you know, like I wouldn't have said that in front of my mother, much less my. And she's talking to the entire student body. And she said, and then I joined this group here. And I saw these kids. And I realized my life had purpose. That's not a red issue or a blue issue. That's a generational issue, in my view. And so she and her peers, I think, will continue to push not just her city, her state, her country, but a global movement that says inclusion has to be the new expectation, the new normative expectation of growth and development.
Great. Thank you, Tim. All right, you've been very patient on this side.
Rest,
we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Let's 5, 6. Yeah, we just remember and keep your hands up. All right, introduce yourself, please.
Hi, my name is Isaiah Moore. I'm here representing the National Association for Federally Impacted Schools. My question kind of stems from fear. There is a fear of what is unknown. And when you go from high school, grammar school to college,
the integration of people with disabilities in the classroom is so out of this world. In high school, I never was in a class with a disabled person. In college, I run into it all the time. How do we combat that stigma of not having kids with disabilities in those high school and grammar school classes? Because that is what's really going to, I mean, I love that sports and other inclusion inside the school is happening, but it has to happen in the classroom, because collaboration on an academic level will really bring a change.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. Down the line, one over here.
My question is in reference to universal design. That's a growing trend that we see in many sectors, and so I have a primary focus in technology. So we see universal design being applied to education. It could. It has not happened yet. But in examples we've seen recently with sign language, that can also be applied with hearing people or deaf people, and we can see a lot of success happening there and allow communication to happen even before speech has happened. So my question is in regards to intellectual disabilities. Besides SEL, what are some other lessons learned that could be applicable to the educational system as a whole so that we can improve educational outcomes, largely speaking?
Great. Thank you. Did we skip over you? Sorry.
Yeah.
Here. Hi, my name is Stephen Linnane. I'm a college student who's studying special education. I also have a sister who has Down syndrome, and she's in high school now. But when she first was about to go into the public schools, my parents fought really hard to bring the inclusive model to our school district, and they were met with a lot of pushback, to put it nicely. What would be your advice to parents on how best to explain to someone the importance of the inclusive education and social emotional learning for a student with a learning disability?
Great question. Okay, next row back. We have a gentleman, then a woman in blue. Go ahead, sir.
Hi. Does the Unified program have any ideas on how to make the inclusivity goals you talked about extend to the staff of the school as well? So making sure that the schools are willing and able to employ people with disabilities too?
Mm. Mm-hmm. That's a great question. On the end here, and then I think there's one more, and we'll turn it back to the panel.
I'm Lorraine Summers. I manage an internship program for college students studying science and engineering. Is there ever a safe space for educators and service providers and everyone else to talk about their own bias rather than all this awareness? You know, I often think about implicit bias, mm-hmm. and if adults can talk about it, share their experiences on the way to moving beyond their emotions. Something like that. I wonder how much of a difference it would make in what we're trying to do.
That's a great question. One last question here. The woman raised. Yes, raise.
Hi. I'm a doctoral candidate at University College London, and I study the teaching of English as a foreign language. So my question was, have coaches for these unified teams been resistant to coach these teams? And if so, how have you persuaded them that it's worth it, and how have their hearts changed as a result? Mm.
So we have great questions, variation on a theme about fear, resistance, whether it's parents or other school personnel or coaches, and what do you do about it? I think that's a sort of one big question in different forms, which is really important. Universal design, employment, of staff at school, and then, of course, the important question around implicit bias. Who wants to start? you don't start.
Okay.
Her, but, yeah.
Well, I'm happy not to start. Thank you.
Cassie and Joe. Well, I'd be curious, actually, I'm personally curious what you think are good strategies that you've seen in terms of combating this resistance. I mean, you say you didn't see much resistance, Cassie, actually.
I don't know if it's because my school is just special, or I really don't, but I personally at my school, there wasn't a lot of resistance at all. It was just a new idea that people were curious to and surprised about. And I just can't say that I saw a lot of
right.
it. I can't.
Joe, what about you?
I didn't see any at all because my coach was into it.
Speaking of coaches, yeah, I have not met a coach who was not fully engaged in what they were doing and didn't love their team and didn't want the best for every student on their team. I mean, I know the coach from my school, he would frame the team picture every year and get like buy frames for everyone and give them up to everyone and have pizza parties like literally every Friday. And I helped with like the culminating event, which is kind of like a sectionals event that happens at the end of every unified basketball season. And all the coaches get up there and announce their teams, and they're nothing but proud, and the energy is so exciting. So I can't say that through that and through I hosted one of the youth activation summits for, to kind of get kids to come in and learn about what we're doing. And a lot of the times coaches and advisors come to that as well. I think the people that are involved are the people that want to be involved and
right.
want to make a change. And
so the question is, we need to go to our more older and world-weary panelists.
That's well, we had, this that's is, not me, is
this,
it?
This, the you basically heard, a sample of two proving your point about this being the most inclusive generation because they haven't felt much resistance. But you guys have been at this for a long time. I'm sure
right.
you've encountered
right.
resistance.
Well, I
it's
think,
a really good question. What do you do about
yeah.
it?
Well, there's a question regarding the parental resistance. Yeah. And I think the question had to do with the parent of an individual with disabilities not feeling comfortable. Is that?
They were my parents.
Oh, your parents were yeah. other parents. Okay. All right. Well, I think, and I've met the reverse. I've seen parents, interestingly enough, of children with disabilities, and spoken to them, who actually did not want inclusion because of fear of how the kid might have been treated or perceived. So I think I've seen it both ways. And I think it stems from, as someone mentioned, the fear of the unknown. I think sometimes not knowing what the reaction would be, to the individual. And I think if the issue of the culture and climate of the school, if there's some way to communicate to the parents who are resisting the child with disability or the parent of the child, of the child with disability, if there's a way to communicate that there is a culture and climate that respects the dignity of every child, I mean, I think that has to be clear in the mission and vision statements. It has to be in the cultural symbols of the school. And I think that has to be very clearly communicated. I think that's one of the surest ways to actually address that issue. Tying that in with the question of individuals with disabilities in the classroom and inclusion in the classroom, it's sometimes a challenging issue. Because, as we know, some individuals with disabilities have IEPs, and the IEPs in schools do have certain requirements and certain specifications. And so sometimes I think the school setting is driven by and governed by some of those requirements. And sometimes they are probably not quite comfortable, moving away from or beyond those specific requirements, and so I think that. I think there are ways to address the IEP issues and make sure that every child who has an IEP, an individual education plan, gets those objectives met, but also find a way to include, you know, that child in other ways in the classroom activities. It may not be on a full scale basis, but there are ways to do that. I mean, it is done with other things. It is done with kids who have English as a second language. There are dual language programs that have different ways of including kids who are English language learners in ways that they enjoy, you know, the benefit of the classroom, but also get the time that they need to work on what they need to work on. I think that's possible, and I think it's workable, and I'm sure that there are some places that perhaps do that, and maybe there are ways for us to, you know, the research could look into that, I'm sure.
Tim, I'm going to give you the last comment. We have 5 more minutes.
Trying to tell me to cut me off?
No, I'm just for warning you, yeah. Giving you the span of, yeah. But, you know, could you also address this, the last question about implicit bias,
yeah.
Which I'm not sure if this is what you meant, but certainly it connects to the question of fear and resistance. And perhaps there was an underlying implicitness of if educators and school personnel, or all of us really, could, you know, examine our own biases, perhaps
yeah.
We might meet with less fear and resistance.
So I guess, I guess part of the way I'd frame an answer to some of these points would be around, if we start with fear, which is often channeled through unconscious or implicit bias, right? It becomes unconscious and then hidden because of a whole source of psychological factors, which we don't have to get into. So we all carry this, right, of all kinds and types. The extent to which our normative culture allows us safety to express it, and therefore to share it and overcome it, and no longer let it be a barrier for us, is the extent to which we're likely to become self-aware and actually more inclusive. So what happens in a setting, the reason I think these folks here didn't say that they saw any resistance is because they offered something to their culture that was immediately seen as a positive for unlocking shame and fear. Whereas 10 or 20 years ago, people might have said, we're not ready for that yet. You know, we're not ready for those kids. Why? Because the fear and the shame would have been too steep, right? Well, if those kids come in, my kid's going to be damaged. Those kids could have been kids of color, kids of gender, and certainly kids with disabilities. I mean, we can look at the history of this over time. So these interventions, if they do one thing, back to Norris's first point, they create a normative expectation that it is okay to talk things through, that it is okay also to express discomfort. That you shouldn't run away from your discomfort. So, you know, I guess, what would I say to parents? I think is a really good question, because I get asked this sometimes, because I'll get up and I'll talk on and on about how wonderful people with intellectual challenges are, all the things they've taught me. I wrote a whole book about it, trying to figure out how to make it clear. Well, people will say, well, summarize it. What's the point? So what's the opposite of fear, I guess would be the question. Courage, okay. So figure out what your opposite of fear word is. Now, today I think the word that will continue to grow in popularity is happiness. Now, Kelly, don't make fun of me. We had a big staff meeting about a year ago. I said, we should talk about happiness. The whole group made fun of me. This is the worst possible idea. So we don't do it. But I'm not giving
up.
Whole
research theme.
But the happiness, the positive psych world. So what do parents say? I have a child with Down syndrome. Why should you want my child in your school? Because your child's going to be happier. Every child's going to be happier when every child's included. Do you want your child included? I want my child included. Both of our children are going to be happier if both of our children are included. I think the research is very actually strong on this. I think what you've heard in this extraordinary panel is, from a scientific point of view and from an experience point of view, inclusion lifts all boats, right? It's like a tide. And it doesn't just lift a leaking boat, it lifts all boats. Now, So I think we've got to open the culture to conversations about difference that are safe and supported, that allow people to expose and express their biases and fears in safe spaces where they're not going to be labeled or, you know, or called out or fired, for that matter, if they're adults. But also trust that the kids can help us with this, because the kids are going to be much better at it than the adults. Because adults have put many more layers on their biases and many more layers on their fears than kids have. And so you guys didn't see, but what you can't see is that the reason the program wasn't there 5 years ago, before you could, the reason, Joe, you had an initially bad experience was because decades and decades of unconscious bias and fear had created a culture where you felt like you were nothing, as you said in the beginning. And within a few short years, the two of you created cultures where everybody felt like who we are, to your language, is we include. And that's a pretty extraordinary shift, and very, very hopeful, I think, and important for research and policy people to catch up to, in some ways, younger people who are ready to lead this.
I think that's a great note to end on. Thank you.
And I didn't go over 5 minutes.
Exactly. Thank you. Thank you to the panelists. Thank you very much.